Good morning. The next matter on the calendar for oral argument is Tyler Leibfried versus the City of Duluth and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we are welcoming Judge Cochran to join the panel for this argument. Good morning, Council. I know you're all familiar with our procedures here. I'll just remind you that you will each get 15 minutes. Appellant will have 15 minutes. I understand respondents are splitting the 15 minutes equally. And the clock at the podium will reflect that, or the lighting will reflect that. It's important that you identify who you are and the party you represent when you begin your argument. And so when you are ready, Council, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thomas Boyd here on behalf of the relator, Tyler Leibfried. And I'm particularly pleased to be here this morning because about a half hour ago, I had a flat tire on the interstate. It's the nightmare that every advocate has. But fortunately, my wife was available to get me here. So
just one of our colleagues had the same experience on the same road this morning.
Is that right?
Odds of that.
Wow.
I don't know
That's
whether.
That's jinxed.
Yeah.
Officer Leibfried is asking the Court of Appeals to reverse the ULJ's determination that he was terminated from his employment with the Duluth Police Department for employment misconduct, and alternatively, the ULJ's finding that he did not qualify for the good faith error in judgment exception. We ask you to remand with instructions to deed to remit the full amount of employment benefits to which Officer Leibfried is entitled. Alternatively, we would ask you to remand to consider for the ULJ to consider the fact that the city failed to comply with its own policies regarding the review of his conduct in this instance. The basic material facts in this case, as alleged by the parties and as found by the ULJ, really are not disputed. The disputes occur with regard to the application of those facts to the legal standards. And these, of course, are questions of law reviewed de novo, for which this court need not defer to the ULJ. The application of these facts, as found by the ULJ, actually establish Officer Leibfried's conduct did not constitute employment misconduct. The ULJ found that Officer Leibfried's conduct up through the firing of four shots was reasonable in light of the circumstances posed by the threats he perceived. But the ULJ found that his conduct in firing the two final shots constituted employment misconduct because, quote, the objective facts available to Leibfried after he fired the first four shots showed a de-escalation of the threat.
Well, and there was testimony that supported the district or the ULJ's findings, wasn't there?
Well, there was testimony supporting that view that there was a de-escalation of the threat. The point I'd like to make is, nonetheless, by implication, the threat remained. And the de-escalation is a matter of subjective opinion, with Officer Leibfried doing the best he could under the circumstances in real time.
But didn't the ULJ make a credibility determination about whether or not the ULJ believed that at the time between the firing of the first four shots and the firing of the second four shots that additional force was reasonably necessary at that point in time?
The ULJ determined that the officer's conduct as described by the officer and the facts that the ULJ found did not provide a reasonable basis for Officer Leibfried's actions at the time and determined.
Specifically, what I'm asking is, I saw you dealt with this in your reply brief, but you dealt with only one of the credibility determinations that the ULJ made, the one relating to the door moving. There was a second credibility determination above that in the ULJ's decision that says it is not believable that Leibfried continued to believe File was an imminent deadly threat. And then explains, if Leibfried truly believed File remained an imminent deadly threat as long as File was talking, then why did Leibfried stop shooting after the sixth shot? File continued to scream after the sixth shot. Leibfried's testimony on this point was inconsistent with his action and is therefore not reliable. So I know you framed it at the outset of your argument as being an issue of law review de novo, but don't we need to afford great deference to the ULJ's credibility determination there?
You certainly should defer to the ULJ on credibility determinations. I would point out that that portion, or those statements by the ULJ, are in the portion of the decision dealing with whether or not this was employment misconduct, not whether or not it was a bad faith error of judgment or a good faith error of judgment. Second, when the ULJ says it's not believable, he then, and
goes on to. Doesn't your good faith error of judgment argument depend on whether he credibly testified that he continued to think that there was an imminent deadly threat?
It goes to whether or not the ULJ found that he at the time was acting dishonestly or in bad faith, and there are no such findings.
But why isn't this finding relevant to that? That's what I help because me understand.
Certainly, the ULJ was making an observation or a finding as to the reliability of the witness after the fact as a witness, as opposed to what he believed in at the time. And there are, in the context of the discussion regarding whether or not this was a good faith error of judgment, the ULJ states, quote, the opinion or judgment of Liepried formed after hearing the man's initial yelling was that he was lying and was still an imminent deadly threat.
Right, that was in the findings of fact section, but we're required to read the ULJ's decision as a whole, aren't we? And
right.
Then to decide whether or not, if later in the reasons for decision section, there's a credibility determination, then we still have to defer to that, right?
Well, you have to reconcile the two. And when he's discussing whether or not the actions were reasonable, on the one hand, recognize that that's the context in which those statements by the ULJ are being made. And the context of those comments you've recited about believability were made in the context of whether or not this was employment misconduct, i.e., were his actions reasonable? And the ULJ, after making those comments, went on to comment about why the ULJ did not think that was reasonable. But separately and subsequently, the ULJ addressed whether or not it was a good faith error in judgment, and there found that he did believe, although the ULJ thought it was unreasonable, did believe that he continued to be exposed to an imminent threat as a result of what he thought was an ambush situation with an active shooter. So those two have to be reconciled rather than conflated. And I would again emphasize that the ULJ did not find that Officer Liepried did not believe that, did not actually believe it, did not find that he actually thought it was a de-escalation situation, did not find that he was acting in bad faith, he was acting dishonestly or attempting to perpetrate a fraud. Instead, what the ULJ did in the portion of the decision relating to whether it was a good faith exercise of judgment, focused on the objective facts, quote, and this is on the top of page 8 of the decision, quote, all of the objective facts available to Liepried after he fired the first 4 shots showed a de-escalation. An objectively reasonable officer would not have believed, based on the totality of the circumstances, that additional deadly force was necessary to protect the officer or another from imminent threat of death or great bodily harm. Firing the final 2 shots was not a good faith judgment of error. Good faith judgment error.
So isn't that sort of the ULJ's legal conclusion at that point?
That's a legal review
de novo.
That's a repetition of his earlier decision or his earlier finding that, in his view, Officer Liepried was negligent. But as we've cited to a variety of both Black's Law Dictionary as the plain meaning of good faith, as well as the cases from this court and from the Supreme Court, mere negligence is not the equivalent of a lack of good faith. In fact, the statute is written in a way that notwithstanding negligent behavior or conduct, you can still be eligible for the good faith exception.
Well, one of the cases you cite for that, the JEB versus Danks case from 2010, uses Black's Law Dictionary and not only uses the honesty in belief or purpose, but also uses the secondary definition of faithfulness to one's duty or obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's set aside whether or not the ULJ's statement that it was not believable that your client believed at the moment he fired the second two shots that that JF was still a threat. Why wouldn't we also be able to conclude that the ULJ's determinations don't support a finding of bad faith based on lack of faithfulness to duty or obligation?
There was no finding of a lack of faithfulness. There was a finding that he acted unreasonably, but not that he was unfaithful or dishonest.
Unreasonably is with relation to the policies that govern the police department, right?
Which he had in mind. He testified he had those in mind. It's undisputed he had that training. It's undisputed that he testified that he reconnoitered and considered the circumstances. The ULJ simply found that his conclusions about those objective facts was unreasonable. Not that he was unfaithful, not that he was dishonest, not that he or gave up his obligation as a police officer. There's nothing to support that. Instead, the analysis by the ULJ of the good faith error in judgment exception is just a reiteration of the ULJ's conclusion that he was negligent. And I emphasize that in that paragraph of the ULJ's decision, the ULJ's focusing on what an objective officer would consider to be the case, what the objective facts are, what an objective reasonable officer would do.
One of the findings or the statements of the ULJ that Judge Ede referred to earlier, I keep coming back to. The ULJ states, but it is not believable that Liebfried continued to believe Bile was an imminent deadly threat. And it goes on. Isn't that akin to a finding that that was not an honest belief?
I think it's straight, you know, the use of the word believable is somewhat ambiguous. But if you take it in the context of what he states thereafter, the ULJ is expressing the reasons why he thinks that belief would be unreasonable. But again, later on in the section dealing with good faith error of judgment, he states that and finds that the officer believed he was in imminent threat and just determined that that's not what a reasonable officer would conclude. But he found that that's in fact what the officer felt at the time.
In analyzing the good faith exception, is the ULJ always required to accept the officer's subjective belief? Not just in this case, but in any case.
No, but in this case he did, but, as stated.
I guess that's where I'm still not following you, because going back to the language that my colleagues had pointed out and I was asking you about earlier, he says it's not believable, the ULJ says it's not believable that Liebfried continued to believe that Fail was in imminent deadly threat, was an imminent deadly threat. So what language are you relying on to conclude?
Two portions. First, at the bottom of page 4, quote, despite this, Liebfried believed the man inside still posed an imminent deadly threat and was trying to mislead officers by crying out, ow. And then bottom of page 7 and top of page 8, which is the portion of the decision dealing with whether or not it's a good faith error of judgment. Quote, the opinion or judgment Liebfried formed after hearing the man's initial yelling was that the man was lying and was still an imminent deadly threat, period. Quote, but good faith belief must have a reasonable basis. And that's where the ULJ then reiterates a negligence analysis. So this court would need to reconcile those statements. And the only way in which those statements by the ULJ can be reconciled is by interpreting the section that Judge Ede had referenced to about believability as a reasonableness analysis, because the ULJ makes that statement and then expresses his views, as to why the ULJ considers that to be unreasonable. And that's in the context of...
I'm sorry.
Sure.
to read the two sections you just quoted as the ULJ's statement of what your client's view was, what he testified to, what his position was,
right.
and the more specific statement that the ULJ did not find that belief to be believable to be the ULJ's conclusion. Isn't that a better way to harmonize reading the whole decision as a whole?
You won't be surprised by my response. I don't think it would be. Again, because those statements, the believability is in the context of whether it was employment misconduct, not in terms of whether it was a good faith error of judgment. Secondly, even taking it as a whole, nowhere in the four corners of the ULJ's decision is there any finding that the officer at the time, as opposed to assessing his reliability as an expert, as a witness after the fact, at the time, acted dishonestly, acted in bad faith, acted in a way to defraud anyone. There was no finding that he was acting in a way in which he intended in bad faith to harm somebody. Instead, simply that a reiteration of the ULJ's decision or opinion that he was acting unreasonably. But as we've stated, that is not the same as acting in bad faith. So there was no findings to support the ULJ's decision that he was not qualified for the good faith exception.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Right. Thank you.
Now we will turn to Respondent Deeds' argument. It's under the middle.
Oh, okay. Got it. Thank you. Okay. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent Respondent Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I'll be speaking the first 7.5 minutes, and Respondent City of Duluth will be speaking the second 7.5 minutes. So the evidence here shows that the relator seriously violated the Duluth Police Department's policies and training when he fired the last two shots through a closed department door. This is employment misconduct. And I'll talk about some of the ways he violated DPD's reasonable expectations. So first, the relator did not make a continual assessment of the threat and adjust his response after the first four shots. And we have quite a bit of testimony from Sergeant Joel Olnicek, the DPD's use of force expert, and the chief of police about officers' training, and that they are trained to make constant assessments of the threat before, during, and after their use of force, and to be accountable for each shot fired. So here at the time the relator fired the last two shots, 5 to 6 seconds had passed since the first four shots. And during that 5 to 6 second period, nothing else happened to indicate that the person in the apartment was still a threat. So there were no additional loud bangs. There were no sounds of a gun racking. In fact, there was a person in the apartment who was screaming repeatedly, "Stop," and then "Ow." And at this point, the relator had yet to see his target. He had yet to see a weapon or what else was in the apartment, what was between him and his target or beyond his target. And at this point as well, 20 seconds had passed since the first or since the loud bangs. So the deadly force policy states that deadly force should only be used if there are no other options reasonably available. And at this point, we have testimony from both of the police department's witnesses that he had other options at this point. Olnicek testified that the relator could have backed up further into the alcove. He could have stood and listened and gathered more information, tried to hear what was happening behind the door, or importantly, he could have identified himself as a police officer and engaged the person in the apartment in a conversation about if he was hurt, to determine if he was still a threat.
These are all things that go to the officer's exercise of judgment in the moment. I mean, the relator was exercising judgment from the minute he went up the stairs and tried to deal with what he believed to be a domestic abuser or potentially a domestic abuse situation. Where is the line crossed here, and how do we read the ULJ's findings to support the determination that this was not a good faith judgment error.
Okay. Oh, I believe you're right that he was required to use his judgment throughout the incident. And the ULJ draws the line where this 5 to 6 second gap happens, that this is when the facts change and the facts available to him change. As far as the good faith error in judgment analysis, I'll kind of move to that now. The ULJ, as the court has pointed out, does make a credibility determination about the relator's testimony on what he believed when he fired the last two shots. She has about three paragraphs on page 7 here where she talks about, you know, it is not believable that Liebfried continued to believe Feil was an imminent deadly threat. The last sentence of that paragraph says, his testimony on this point was inconsistent with his actions and is therefore not reliable. She goes on to say that his testimony that he believed Feil was pretending to be hurt was not reasonable. I would argue, you know, in the context of this well-developed credibility determination, that calling it unreasonable is also calling it unbelievable, which she's already said. The paragraph after that, she talks about his testimony is not credible.
Can you address whether the good faith judgment exception in addressing that, we apply a subjective standard or an objective standard, or whether the ULJ should have applied a subjective versus an objective standard?
I believe it is a subjective standard that if he did have that belief that he was in, that JF was an imminent deadly threat, that would be a different analysis. I mean, she is analyzing what he believed, what he actually believed at the time.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You go ahead.
I was just going to ask, why don't you think that the good faith definition includes faithfulness to one's duty or obligation in addition to honesty? I can see what you mean by honesty and belief or purpose being subjective, but faithfulness to one's duty or obligation doesn't seem as susceptible to subjectivity.
I would agree with you there. Applying that definition, you know, the analysis is somewhat similar to the rest of the analysis. Was his conduct, did he comply with his duties as an officer to reevaluate the situation? And in that case, you know, the answer would be the same, that he did not. He, like I just talked about, he had the duty to reassess, to pause, to look at other options, to use less deadly options. So applying that second definition, he did not act in good faith because he wasn't complying with those protocols that he was trained on. So the judge here finds that it wasn't a good faith error in judgment because it wasn't reasonable for him to think that he was still in imminent deadly, that there was an imminent deadly threat at that point. And she also finds that it wasn't believable that he believed that. So she's finding that he did not believe that, therefore it was not a good faith error in judgment.
So you're suggesting that we read the paragraph concerning the good faith error judgment in the context with the credibility findings made during the general discussion about whether misconduct occurred?
Yes, I would say the court, case law directs the court to read the decision as a whole, that sentences in the reasons for decision are akin to findings of fact. Reading this as a whole, she has, you know, three well-developed paragraphs about his credibility in that 5 to 6 second period about what he believed at that time. It's consistent with the decision as a whole. It's consistent with the outcome of the decision. It makes the most sense to interpret her credibility, you know, as part of that good faith error in judgment analysis.
Kind of, your time has expired.
I guess I'm coming up. All right.
Thank you.
Counsel.
morning. May it please the court. My name is Maggie Penland, and I represent respondent City of Duluth.
Can I ask you right at the outset, just since you have a limited amount of time, your counterpart from Deed had been the only party to raise mootness as an issue. I just want to be sure before you go any further, do you have any update for us on whether or not there's any issue of mootness regarding back pay, given the arbitration award, which isn't a part of the record here, but is referenced indicating that appellant has been reinstated or relator has been reinstated?
That is not an issue before this court, mootness of the
And I understand what happened in the arbitration is not before the court, but you're saying mootness is not an issue?
Correct.
Okay.
I want to use the time not to reiterate what Ms. Phillips has already gone through, but I do want to briefly talk about the good faith exception. I agree with what Ms. Phillips has explained, that the decision, the ULJ decision, should be read as a whole, and I think that the best way to reconcile the statements that the court has pointed out, the arguably inconsistent statements in the ULJ's decision, is to read her credibility determinations as specific findings describing her analysis of Mr. Liebfried's beliefs. So when in the decision, the ULJ on page 4 talks about Mr. Liebfried's belief about imminent threat, the ULJ is describing Mr. Liebfried's belief without attributing veracity to that belief. Later in the decision, where she talks about the credibility assessment on pages 6 and 7, primarily page 6 of the decision, that is where the ULJ is specifically making findings about the credibility, the honesty of Mr. Liebfried's beliefs about whether or not he faced imminent threat.
Did the ULJ consider all of the officer's testimony regarding the situation and his testimony about why his view changed after he fired the last two shots in terms of whether he was still facing an imminent deadly threat?
I believe the ULJ did consider everything that Mr. Liebfried testified about his reasons why he believed he was facing an imminent deadly threat. The reasons that Mr. Liebfried provided that he believed he was facing an imminent deadly threat, according to him, were that the person behind the door continued talking. The ULJ determined that that was not credible or not a credible reason for him to believe that he was still facing an imminent threat, because even after Mr. Liebfried fired the additional two shots, that person behind the door continued talking. That was one of the reasons. Another reason was the door movement. Again, in the ULJ's decision, she found that that testimony about the door moving was not credible because Mr. Liebfried had not previously disclosed that in the BCA interview immediately following the incident or in the prior unemployment hearing. The last reason that Mr. Liebfried provided for his alleged belief that he was facing an imminent threat was his claim that when the person behind the door said, ow, that they were pretending to be hurt. And on page 6 of the ULJ's decision, sort of sandwiched between the two paragraphs where she talks specifically about believability, she indicates that that belief that the person behind the door was pretending to be hurt was unreasonable, because it was unreasonable to believe that a person in that situation would be cunning enough to feign injury. As Ms. Phillips pointed out, I too believe that that the ULJ's decision specifically about pretending was a credibility determination as well. There is a difference between saying, I believe what you're telling me, but I find it unreasonable, and saying, what you're saying is so unreasonable, it is not believable. And I believe that reading the ULJ's decision as a whole, when she talks about the reasonableness of Mr. Files' belief that the person behind the door was feigning injury, she is saying the latter. I find your alleged belief so unreasonable as to not be believable. I think that is the way that this decision could be read best as a whole, and that is findings with respect to good faith.
So you would then, looking to the statute, you would say that because it's not believable, you couldn't have had made a good faith error in judgment.
Correct. And that's using Relator's definition of good faith error in judgment from Black's Law Dictionary, the 11th edition, as a state of mind consisting in honesty and belief or purpose. I think those findings address that according to Relator's definition. As Your Honor has pointed out, there is another definition in Black's Law Dictionary, and in one of the decisions cited in the record, the JEB decision, that good faith can also be defined as faithfulness to one's duty or obligation. Certainly under that standard, the ULJ did make findings that Mr. Liebfried did not meet the exception of having a good faith error in judgment. He did not demonstrate faithfulness to his duty to protect the citizens of Duluth. Briefly, in case this comes up in rebuttal, I do want to respond to one thing that Mr. Boyd mentioned during his presentation and in his reply brief with respect to the Duluth Police Department's alleged violation of their own policies. He's obviously referring to the Use of Force Review Board policy. This is a non-issue. That policy is not in the record before this court. And that issue was not raised in the unemployment proceedings. It wasn't raised because it's not relevant. The Use of Force Review Board policy, it is cited in his brief, and you can see in that policy that it specifically states that the Use of Force Review Board does not have the authority to make recommendations regarding discipline. To allege that that review board needed to meet before a termination decision was made is inaccurate.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Boyd, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Boyd, before you get too far down the road, can you also address whether this case is moot given your contention in your reply brief that the arbitrator ordered Officer Liebfried reinstated to his position and made whole for losses due to the termination of his employment?
We agree it is not moot.
So why would it be appropriate, assuming we were to agree with your arguments on appeal, why would it be appropriate for the officer to receive unemployment compensation if he's getting back pay, given that the purpose of unemployment compensation is to provide a bridge for people that aren't being paid their regular salary?
Well, two reasons. First of all, by statute, his status as his eligibility status becomes permanent after a period of time. It can't be changed. And I think the deed counsel can articulate that more.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
More clearly than I. Secondly, it is our position that he was unemployed at no fault of his own. For both, it was not employment misconduct, and he qualifies for the good faith error exception. Responding further to Judge Ide's question about the alternative good faith definition, faithfulness to duty, I would like to further respond that under the structure of this statute, to the extent that were to otherwise be included as part of the definition of good faith, here the structure of subdivision 6 of statute 268.095 encompasses that faithfulness concept because it's focusing on whether or not the conduct is adhering to standards of behavior, which would be faithfulness to duty and so forth. And then goes on to say, notwithstanding that, if there's a good faith error of judgment, there is no misconduct, which would then bring into focus solely whether or not the officer was acting honestly and in good faith, and or honestly and not for the purpose of seeking to defraud. Secondly,
let me ask you a question though,
yes,
about that.
Certainly.
So, say we adopt your view that it's limited to the honest aspect of good faith. I think this kind of goes to what was argued by your counterparts as to whether or not that would give an officer in these situations carte blanche to then in every use of force incident that was in violation of department policy say, well, I was honestly afraid. And there will be, is it your view that there's no reasonableness analysis of that?
And that, as long as
an officer says, I am honestly afraid and that's why I'm using this lethal force, then the ULJ is required to give them a pass?
Yeah, if the ULJ so finds. Not that it's carte blanche, but in fact, in the exercise of judgment, even if it's poor judgment, even if it's a mistake, the exception still applies. And we've cited to the unpublished decision in Sharp, where the ULJ found this was totally in violation of the employer's procedures and so on and so forth. And in fact, it was a totally stupid thing to do. It was imbecilic to use this golf court cart the way this guy was doing it. But the court recognized he was exercising judgment. And even if reasonable people would not do that, in fact, this employee believed that it was the appropriate thing to do at the time. But to further respond to the point that you've made and the other members of the panel have made, there appears to be some need to clarify, one, although we seem to agree that it's a subjective standard rather than an objective standard, but also whether or not it focuses on honesty and an absence of effort or intent to defraud, as opposed to the secondary definition that you've identified from the JB case. So this may be a case, one way or another, this court should publish to provide some clarity for the ULJ, who did not find bad faith, who did not find a lack of honesty or an intent to defraud. So that the ULJ in this case, as well as in other cases, will have clear guidance on how to apply the good faith error of judgment standard. One last point, 4 seconds. The issue regarding the policy or the failure to adhere to the policy was not raised before the ULJ because we did not know about it until the arbitration, which was after the ULJ hearing. So that's the reason why it wasn't brought up earlier.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your arguments today. They were helpful. And we will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the final matter on our calendar for oral arguments, so we will recess.
Please rise.